Psychiatric disorders don't always look the way they are spelled out in the DSM. Today, we hear from clinicians who have lived with psychiatric disorders on how to sharpen our interviewing skills. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
There are people who have only looked at the map or quote unquote read the books, but I'm like, I've actually traveled the territory and been through some of those, you know, deep, dark places that I feel like I just have a different perspective.
In the mid-1980s, Kay Redfield Jameson gathered all the courage she could muster to tell her department chair that she had manic depressive illness. The place was Johns Hopkins University, where Dr. Jameson worked as a psychologist in the psychiatry department. The chair, Paul McHugh, did not respond as she expected.
Kay, dear, I know you have manic depressive illness. He paused and then laughed. If we got rid of all the manic depressives on the medical school faculty, not only would we have a much smaller faculty, it would be a far more boring one.
Dr. Jameson later came out to the world through her 1995 bestseller, An Unquiet Mind. Her brave steps were followed by Steve Hayes, who developed acceptance and commitment therapy in part to treat his own panic disorder, and Marcia Linehan, who disclosed her own history of borderline personality disorder, suicidality, and long-term hospitalizations to the New York Times in 2011. In this episode, we're going to hear from people working in the field who have lived with psychiatric disorders of all kinds, some in recovery, some still in the struggle.
The people who reached out to us were a select group, self-aware enough to get help and open enough to share their story. But the problems they lived with were not mild. Half reported inpatient stays, psychotic episodes, or work-related disability. One had a vagal nerve stimulator implanted for depression, and two credited ECT with saving their lives. Among our 14 interviewees were five psychiatrists, five psychiatric NPs, two psychiatric PAs, an RN, and a therapist. We're going to bring you insights from these interviews in this Wounded Healers series.
So I really wish we had another word besides wounded healers. It makes it all sound like we're all frail little birds hobbling around on one leg, caring for other people instead of ourselves. Or it's almost condescending, like we have some kind of special magnanimous power.
Yeah, it's like it's exaggerated on both sides. You're broken and you have a superpower. Sorry, I couldn't think of a better word. And I couldn't think of any one word that fit with all the viewpoints we heard from. So we put the title in parentheses. There were some common themes in these interviews, but a lot of differences. Some wanted their name withheld, and some wanted it disclosed in the hope that doing so would bring down stigma. That was a tough decision, but I remember a patient of mine who came out about having bipolar disorder in an interview with a local newspaper, and later she came to regret it due to the effects on her career that she hadn't anticipated, but, you know, once the genie gets out of the bottle, you can't put it back in with the internet. So I've decided, with great apologies, to withhold all names from all interviewees in this podcast.
These interviews changed me in a lot of ways, like how I speak with patients. Living with a psychiatric illness gives people a richer language to talk about it, and a sharper intuition for picking up on it. They understand how bad things can get and resist the temptation to minimize problems even when patients lead us that way.
For me, I think one of the biggest frustrations I've found is that whenever I present one of my providers for a fall, things like that, I'm usually like in a good mood, very outgoing, because I'm seeking help. We're going to talk about stuff. And if things aren't going well, the intent is to make things better. And so, like, we're having a conversation and things go pretty well. And I found a lot of providers tended to minimize, well, I'd minimize too, but like, they'd minimize their presentation, like, well, you're doing well. Things aren't that bad. You're describing something here and there, but functioning is pretty good overall. And I'd be like, dude, we just talked about me like laying on the couch wanting to kill myself for like 3 hours straight. I'm not doing that well, but I'm presenting well because we're here doing good stuff. And so there was a lot of anxiety from the patient side as far as like, how do I present this? What do I say? I don't want to say too much and make it sound crazy, even though, look, sometimes my life really is like that. They may not believe me or disagree. And so I found that I like to think that I'm a lot more in consider how my patients are presenting. And so if they're telling me like, yeah, I'm not doing great, I'm having a hard time, while they're sitting in their truck, like just kicking back, relaxing, whatever, because I do a lot of telemedicine. It's like, well, maybe there's something more in depth to look at here. And I found a lot of providers minimize that for me. And it didn't always go well with that.
One psychiatrist spoke to us of a cheat code he uses to get to the heart of the matter with patients.
There's a shared understanding of people with mood disorders because we've had them. And it is a little bit of a cheat code. I mean, my patients have taught me a lot of it. I don't have OCD at all. And I see a lot of people who have that. And I have learned from them. So it's possible. But I think some of how we frame our questions can be tremendously helpful. So for example, I like to ask questions like, so how often do you not take your medicine? Or how have you not killed yourself? So I'm assuming suicidality in that question. Then they can correct me if I'm wrong. Oh, I've never been suicidal if they want to. Many people are and you're not. Okay, thanks for correcting me. But it destigmatizes, because of the built-in assumption in the question, the concept that one might be suicidal. I had a patient for many years, never disclosed suicidality. And I said, there's no way you're not suicidal in one visit. Like, there's no way you're not thinking about killing yourself. Like, I can see that you're so sad. The look on your face is so sad. I call bullshit. You got to be thinking about death. And she's like, yeah, you're right. And it would just send me to the hospital. I'm like, yeah, but you've met me. Like, I'm not going to do that if that's not going to be helpful. But, and that just opened the floor and we can finally talk about it. It's their secrets people are keeping from you. Assume they're keeping secrets and acknowledge that they're keeping secrets and that it's good judgment to not tell you everything, because how do they know they can trust you? Most people who have these experiences think about death, dying, or suicide. You haven't brought it up yet. Okay. What's up with that?
Sometimes people can have very vague answers when you ask them about suicidal ideation or self-harm. And I think we have to know how to touch onto that and explore it further. Because maybe they don't want to be forthright with what they're really experiencing. And if you kind of can tell them, hey, I get it, you know, it can look like this, that, or the other for someone who's experiencing these thoughts. Does any of that resonate for you? That's also how I ask about trauma for patients, is not directly, do you have sexual trauma or emotional trauma? I say, hey, these are the types of trauma. Any of those resonate with you?
Also being aware with trauma that there are different kinds of trauma that neglect, just growing up in a dysfunctional home and having some neglect, that's kind of the little T traumas. And that you hear the saying that trauma isn't always the bad thing that happened to you, but it's also the good things that never happened. And teasing that out a little bit more with patients has been helpful for me, I guess, because I tend to minimize my own trauma myself. So I'm always kind of trying to look at that with patients, always looking at ACEs and digging a little bit more there. If I just asked, oh, have you been sexually abused, physically abused, anything, those kind of rapid fire yes, no questions, where you don't dig into what was childhood like for you? Did you have food insecurity? People don't think about that as really in their trauma assessment.
These providers had an understanding of psychiatric symptoms that went a little deeper than the DSM.
I feel like there's a real flavor to postpartum OCD and OCD in general. So if my spidey senses are telling me that that's what's going on, then I'll start to kind of flirt with things like, you know, some people have intrusive thoughts like this. And I'll kind of keep throwing things out there until I see that micro expression of like, oh my gosh, other people have the urge to say that word out loud. Like they can't control it.
Clinicians with bipolar disorder were particularly vivid in their descriptions of manic symptoms.
When it's someone who has them, either the mixed state or they have bipolar two, I'll go into more specifics there too about like, so have you ever felt like you're, you know, when you're on Google, you've got all these thoughts and these like ideas like, wow, I want to do this and I want to do that. And you're opening tabs and your mind is going to the next project or the next addition to the project faster than you can open up tabs. Like, yeah, I do too.
you know, I hear most often, even in professors in graduate school, when they explain mania, for instance, they'll say, oh, yeah, they really love it. And it's like a super high for them. And I'm like, hey, I don't think you're explaining that correctly. You know, I think it can come with a lot of irritability, anxiety, could be in the context of a mixed episode as well, where that person could be suicidal too. And it's not always very comfortable to be manic. Sure, that is appealing for a lot of people if it's a certain way, but there's also another side of it too that I don't think is fared very well in higher education.
In the 1970s, researchers went into the psychiatric wards and asked patients who were hospitalized for mania what brought them there. Depression was the most common answer. In my own practice, I rarely see euphoric mania. It does exist, but it tends to last a few days at most before it turns into an inpatient, irritable, anxious, or even a mixed state.
Let's pause for a preview of the CME quiz for this episode. Earn CME for this podcast through the link in the show notes, or click on Podcast under the multimedia link on the Carlatt Report website. 1. Which anxiety symptom is particularly resonant with panic disorder, according to our interviews with clinicians who have lived experience? A. Free-floating anxiety. B. Spontaneous, uncued attacks. C. Feeling of impending doom. D. Palpitations. The DSM doesn't always paint a clear portrait of the disorders it describes, because it focuses on symptoms that are specific to the illness, the ones that separate it statistically from other disorders, rather than the symptoms that are most common. The people I see with depression are much more likely to complain of anxiety than a low appetite. But anxiety isn't in the DSM list because it's shared by so many disorders. One provider spoke further of the hidden symptoms of depression.
Everyone knows the DSM criteria for major depression, but there are some symptoms that I think we do overlook. A lot of somatic complaints, they come in and they have a lot of aches and pains and just feeling worn down. You know, they may not have the psychomotor retardation classically that we would think. They may walk in there at a normal pace, but they feel like, you know, putting one foot in front of the other is mentally exhausting. So kind of teasing out those somatic complaints and the DSM criteria, you have to have some kind of social or occupational functioning impairment. But there are some people that don't fit neatly into the DSM that are going to work every day, are white knuckling it through life and work and home, and everything is an effort. And they may not have had an appetite change. They may not have visible psychomotor retardation, but they're still white knuckling it through life, self-medicating at home with food or alcohol or whatever to get through that day. And that kind of soul dampening darkness that is hard to describe, you can't put it in a DSM. So you kind of have to learn how to tease out the severity of those symptoms, and being able to put words to that has been helpful.
For a clinician with schizoaffective disorder, all three phases of the illness were felt physically.
I think the electricity and the speeding up is the hypomania, and the feeling like a sandbag might be the depression. And I think these like senses of like being fragmented in your body are psychotic. Instead of like just what are you thinking, what are you feeling in your emotions, it's like, do you have like that sense of fire in your chest? Are you like feeling like there's electricity going through your body? Do you feel like a sandbag? You feel ripped apart.
As Kelly said, anxiety is one of the most common symptoms in psychiatry, and also one of the most overused words in our offices. When a patient uses the word anxiety, it can bias us toward an anxiety diagnosis, even though they may be talking about paranoia, obsessions, phobias, or the uncomfortably elevated energy of a mixed state. I'll never forget the time I misdiagnosed a patient with social anxiety disorder when he was really having negative symptoms of schizophrenia, not something I'm proud of. To avoid that bias, I'll often substitute the word anxiety with distress in my head as I'm doing the interview. There are no anti-distress meds, so doing that helps me avoid reflexively reaching for an anti-anxiety med like a benzo. And if you look up the word anxiety, you'll see one of the definitions is distress.
Anxiety looks different, even among the anxiety disorders, as a psychiatrist with panic disorder explained.
Yeah, I'll never forget my first panic attack, and I think that's quite common in people that have panic disorder. They never forget that first time. Yeah, I was driving, which was very scary. A very scary place to have a panic attack is on the road, and I just had to pull over. I had this just fear of that something bad was going to happen, and that symptom is so, it's so salient to me now as a clinician when I hear it from patients. That feeling of impending doom, that to me is very resonant. So I'll never forget that experience. And it just sort of came out of nowhere, right? Just completely unexpected, which for me, the language in the DSM makes a lot more sense now when they say recurrent, unexpected, you know, attacks, sort of unprovoked things, makes a lot of sense to me.
That pearl about remembering the first panic attack is very useful in an interview. If panic disorder goes on too long, it can build up to a cascade of unending anxiety that no longer resembles the classic uncued attacks of the early illness. When asked then if their anxiety attacks are spontaneous or triggered, patients are likely to list dozens of triggers: stress, driving, going to Walmart, conflict, loud noises. What's happened is that they've come to associate the panic attacks with random events, and those panic attacks no longer seem spontaneous to them. But remember, the DSM requires that only one of the attacks was uncued. So you have to dig back to that first attack to clarify the diagnosis. I think of a middle-aged woman whom I was convinced had lifelong generalized anxiety disorder. That's exactly what it looked like for many years, until I asked her what she was like as a child. "I didn't have any anxiety," she said, which shocked me, "until that first panic attack when I was 15 years old. When we got her diagnosis right, we got the treatment right, too."
Some symptoms are left out of the DSM altogether, as this clinician in recovery from alcohol use disorder explained.
One thing that I think about a lot, and this is something that I've talked to with like other people in the field who are also in recovery, and we kind of chat about it, is I do think there's an aspect of alcohol, like, you know, if we kind of move away from alcohol use disorder and kind of think about, like, I guess, alcoholism, that maybe there's like some personality aspects for the addict that don't necessarily go away when the substance is put down. In social gatherings with other people who are in recovery, you know, we have a lot of the same kind of ways of, you know, one of the things that people talk about a lot who are in recovery is kind of like walking into a room and kind of looking at everybody and trying to figure out if you're like the worst person there or the best person there, you know, and there's kind of no in between. And it's something that's really consistent for people in recovery. And I do wonder sometimes if there's like kind of a personality component that goes with alcohol use disorder that we can work on once someone's kind of moved into like in remission stages. Is there something that kind of in a personality that increases the risk for relapse?
A big thank you to everyone who shared their story in this episode.
We'll be back with more insights from wounded healers. In the meantime, the May edition of Carlat Psychiatry News will be out in a few days. To find it, click on Webinars on the Carlat Report website. It's under the Multimedia tab. The Carlat Report is one of the few CME publications that depends entirely on subscribers. Thank you for helping us stay free of commercial support.